folks in the audience know, we're not going to be holding a hearing or work session on Senate Bill 532 today. We're going to roll that over till Thursday. And I wanted to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 290, and I'd like the committee staff to describe the amendments, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, today we're looking at the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 290. These are almost identical to the Dash 3s that we had up in committee the last time we looked at this bill, with one exception, which I'll point out. At the bottom of page 1, it replaces the reference to a public applicator with a reference to, quote, a government entity or any location intended for public use or access. What that's getting at are cases in which the best site is being applied by some kind of a public entity. Let's see. The Dash 4s are essentially a gut and stuff of the entire bill. It gets rid of the fee component of the bill, but it does make the pesticide use reporting system permanent by eliminating the sunset.
It removes the sunset. Okay. Do we have a motion on the Dash 4s?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 290.
Senator Bodick has moved the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 290. Senator Beyer, do you want to take a moment and look at those, or do you?
I assume you're on 290-4s?
Yeah, this is the committee staff just introduced them. Essentially, it is very similar to the Dash 3s, except it removes the fee component of the bill is gone. It also removes the sunset of the pesticide use reporting.
I'll be a no.
Okay. Just wanted to get you oriented. Okay, Katie, could you please call the roll on the Dash 4 amendments?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson? Chair Ringo?
Aye. And motion passed. Is there a...
Chair?
Yes.
I would move Senate Bill 290 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved Senate Bill 290 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Didn't the bill have a subsequent referral with the Budget Committee or Ways and Means?
Well, we've removed the fiscal aspect of it.
Do we need to include a motion?
You want to do a motion to rescind the referral?
I move that we rescind that we rescind the referral to the Budget Committee and send Senate Bill 290 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Burdick has moved that we recommend that the referral to Ways and Means be rescinded and that we move Senate Bill 290 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
I'll still be a no.
Okay. Katie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson? Chair Ringo?
Aye. And motion is passed. And Senator Shields, would you like to carry the bill?
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1037. Say open a work session on Senate Bill 1037.
Sure.
And to our committee staff, Chris Crane, we heard this bill in almost this identical form a week ago. Could you just outline where we are on the bill today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have received back from Legislative Council the formal LC draft 1037-2. It does track very closely the concept draft that we reviewed a week ago. There have been a couple of changes. Would you like to hear about those?
Sure. Why don't you clarify the changes for us?
In the amendments to Measure 37 itself, in Section 2 on page 4, there are a number of exceptions to the type of land use regulations that are subject to Measure 37. Still included are the coastal gulls, Steens Mountain, Hart Mountain, Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and the scenic waterways. We removed provisions relating to aggregate mineral mining and the provision relating to the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area.
another significant change of significance on, let's see, in section 12 dealing with farmland classifications, pages 19 and 20. Section 12 defines high-value farmland for purposes of this bill in Measure 37, and added to that at the bottom of page 20 is subsection 8, defining the Dundee Hills, McMinnville, and Yamhill Carlton viticultural areas. Those would be included in the definition of high-value farmland. The remaining provisions, unless something escapes me, I think the remaining provisions are the same, with the possible exception of the applicability date included as section 53 would make the bill retroactive to the date Measure 37 became effective, December 2nd, 2004. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I'd like to ask the folks from Revenue, Paul Warner and Mazin, if you would come forward and explain your analysis of the House bill that's referenced in Senate Bill 1037.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office, and with me is Mazin Malik from Legislative Revenue. We have been working with the Chair and with Representative Nolan on some potential revenue sources that would fund a compensation fund. And we really looked at three different types of approaches. The first would be based on back property taxes for specially assessed farm and forest land property. That could be done either as a collection of back taxes over an extended period in which they were specially assessed, or it could be done looking forward in terms of what the property tax gains would be as the property left its special assessment status. We've looked at things in two components. One would be the difference between the property assessed in a special assessed status and its highest and best use under current regulations. And then the second component would be its increase in value as it went to a new unregulated status. So there are two real components to it. The third area we've looked at really is at the same base, but taxing it in a different way, and that's the proposal under House Bill 3484 that would look at the increased value as a capital gain. And that's what your worksheet there that Mazin has prepared that you have in front of you. And I'll let Mazin walk through that with you and explain the numbers and emphasize the areas where we've made assumptions that were some that we're somewhat comfortable with and others we're still not real comfortable with. And he'll let you know where those are.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mazin Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. As Paul mentioned, we're working on three main concepts of funds, what we call Fund A, B, C, for the lack of definite naming convention at this point. But this would be addressing the Fund C, or what we call the in the House bill, the...
Could you just speak a little bit louder, Mason? That'd be fine. Thank you.
People usually tell me to lower my voice, Mr. Ochoa. That's
maybe I just think if you talk louder, it'll make it easier for me to understand this tax stuff.
Okay. So the House Bill 3484 talks about developing what it defined as the Development Rights Equalization Assessment, and that's the Fund C as we define it. And what it does, it puts a 20% assessment on property at the time of either rezoning or at the time of the first sale or inclusion in the UGB, the urban growth boundary. So what do we start with in the sheet that you're looking at? And these
probably will be the same numbers, the same data we will be working with on estimating the different funds that the Senate bill talks about, too. Is we start with what we know in the types of land. So we have farmland and forest land, both western and eastern forest lands, small tract forest, and so on. Some of these numbers are, we don't have them in the record. So we will use the ones we have in order to substitute for the ones we don't. But those basically come into an issue when we have the assessed value of all these lands as we are today. It's about $12 billion dollars of not taxed value. We're talking about total acres of these different types of land of about 23.6 million acres that you would find. Those come in about 250,000, 249,000 accounts, tax accounts that is in around the state. Now, what we also know is what the real market value on the books for these lands. Now, the assumptions that we have to make is we have to start with a percentage of how many of these acres, how many of these lands will come into effect and start getting into the Measure 37 redevelopment or rechange of status, if you will. And the most reasonable that I found that could be conducive to this argument is a 1% of the total state lands. This is about 237,000 acres. The total acres we have in your sheet is 0.24, but it's rounding of 237,000 acres. Those acres are primarily estimated in the following way. We're thinking that it's about, that will make it 500 parcels of 500 acres pieces. Well, let me put it, 500 acres, 500 of those. The state in general is growing, our population is growing at about 45,000-46,000 people a year. Thinking that we round it about 50,000 and you assume requirements, general loose requirements, about 10 people an acre, you're talking about 5,000 acres a year of coming into. And if you do that, you will maintain a supply of about 45 years ahead for that type of land at the 1% level. Of course, having different assumptions will change the whole market assumption on what kind of price regulates and so on, and you will be dealing with a whole different set of problems at that time. In general, if you do take that 10 people per acre type of argument, you're looking at something that will accommodate about 2.4 million people in the state, additional people. So to take that real market value of this 1%, it's about what we see in the books today, and the property tax records, is about 226 million. That 226 million comes to almost an average of less than $1,000 per acre. If the 20% applies against that level of real market value, which means that today you will still sell these lands or incorporate them on the same real market value as they are today, and apply the 20% rate to them, you would be looking at one shot total of about $45 million of revenue. However, it is reasonable to expect that once those lands start coming into the UGB of development, that the land, the value, the price will escalate quickly. However, it's difficult to pin a number on this escalation. So we've put a number of scenarios on what would be a reasonable price for land or per acre. So we applied it for 2.5 times, 5 increments, 10 and 20. And that basically cross bounds to about $1,000 per acre up to, when we get to the $20,000 per acre. And the revenue that results from the 20%, there's a lot of 20s here, go from $45,113,226,452 and $904 million at the 20 multiple increase in price. Now, of course, the other assumption is not all of this land will come on to the system immediately. I mean, you will not have that influx of new supply. Otherwise, the whole supply-demand kind of equation will get to a point where everything, even existing property, will start losing price, and the diffusion of the price to what previously have not been regulated, and you would have a whole different set of issues to deal with then. So we've assumed a pattern of the inclusion of those 1% into the lands that would be subjected to Measure 37, and we put the pattern from the fiscal year of 05 to fiscal year 16, starting with 19%, then, because that would probably be the largest influx of claims that you would have, or you could substitute that fiscal year 05 with the first year to be practicing Measure 37 claims, and how many acres would that bring in into this new development types, with the 19% giving about 45,000 acres. And then we've put in the matrix what kind of tax at the 20% level that is described in the House bill at the different value increases, whether it is current value and over the 10 years, that will give you the 46 million, the same 46 million or 45 million we've talked about, but we've built in an increase of natural increase of price. And then you were talking also about the different levels of multiple in the prices. So that goes all the way to $925 million. That's hopefully in a nutshell what this analysis is doing. We're trying to estimate the same type of thing for the funds that you're looking at, of where the counties will get two different funds. One of them would be to recapture all the assessment or the special assessments that was for the last few years, either 10 years or the last 30 years, or since the inception, since the beginning of the of ownership. The problem that faces one with that is which tax regime you apply to the BEC, because remember we've changed tax regimes through time. Today we live under Measure 50 tax regime. A few years ago it was Measure 5, and before that we had a tax base, and in the early 80s we had separation between the different types of value, and even before that we had another tax base. So there's at least four or five different tax regimes that you would expect or hope that the counties would have either the data or the record for what they had, or you need to make certain assumptions of how to capture or recapture either the value and the rates.
Yes, and just a couple questions. Excuse me, the block that you have at the bottom where you've got acres, 237,000 acres, and then below that you've got the sum of numbers. Is it your, and I understand you've got a lot of assumptions built into this, but Is that your best assumption? Your best assumptions that lead to that stream of revenue, the 45 million and then the 23 million and then the 21 million?
That's under the different, well, for not having a best assumption of them all, one would state few and try to get to where
to be conservative.
Where things would most likely happen. I need to do a little more contacts with different sources to know what really do you expect from today's current markets or current market on the books. How much would it really escalate when the Measure 37 is in progress? An increase of 5 multiples, that's about $5,000 an acre, that does not sound way out of contention. $20,000 an acre, especially in those lands that are coming into the Measure 37 process, because there is an incentive to go and apply for Measure 37 claim. If that is the case, then the amount of money, amount of appreciation in value have really occurred in a way that makes it worth it to do something of that sort.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
This actually goes to, under existing land use law, if land is taken out of farm deferral or forest deferral, the people have to pay the back taxes for the amount of benefit that they've gotten of farm deferral. How does this fit into this analysis? Maybe Mr. Crane could provide some insight in that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, under existing law, when land is taken out of one of the beneficial assessments, EFU land, forest land, wildlife habitat, the statute currently requires the back taxes be paid for a period of 5 or 10 years, depending on the exact category of assessment. As amended in 1037-2, the amount of back taxes owable would be either that statutory amount or the period, the total period for which that owner has been receiving the beneficial assessment, whether or not continuous.
Okay, and so that would go into this account.
That's correct. The special assessment back tax recapture would go into city and county accounts. The equalization assessment that is referred to in House Bill 3484 would generate revenue to be placed into account available to the state and state agencies. So there would be 3 separate accounts, one for cities, one for counties, and one for the state.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, excuse me, and also the section of Senate Bill 1037-2 that references this is Section 54, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
And so essentially, although it doesn't reference House Bill 3484 by name, the effect of Section 54 of Senate Bill 1037 is to say that it becomes effective only when House Bill 3484 becomes law.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Byron.
Thank you. When would the new tax be paid under Senate Bill 3044?
The Mr. Chair, Senator Byron, the tax is defined in different times, either at the time of the inclusion in the UGB or at the rezoning, time of rezoning. And they could either pay it immediately and take the time of the first sale, if you will. So there are 3 different possible times, I guess, when the House bill refers to where it could be paid. However, they also look at a mechanism of refunding if there was an overpayment and so on. That's how I believe the House bill has put the process.
A question, a clarification from Chris. You said the back taxes payable under this bill would be what is statutory or what?
Or the maximum period which that owner has received the beneficial assessment. So if you've been getting the statutory period would be 10 years, but if you've been receiving the special assessment for 12 years, you'd be charged the back taxes for the 12-year period.
So if
and that's only property taxes under the farm forest recap.
I understand that. So under current law, if a person rezones his property, if he's able to, it's farm deferral, he pays 10-year back taxes. If he's owned that property for 20 years, under this bill, he would pay 20 years back taxes?
If they'd been receiving the beneficial assessment for that period, that's correct.
Okay. And a clarification on the 3484, we don't have the bill in front of us, so I'm speaking from memory, but it is more in the nature of an income tax rather than a property tax and would be payable, strictly speaking, on April 15th with your other income taxes, with all of the provisions for early payment or recovery of overpayment.
Could be delayed to November.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much, both of you. I appreciate your explanation. Just to be clear, we are in work session on Senate Bill 1037, and Chair moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 1037. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll be opposing the Dash 2 amendments, but I want to make it very clear on the record that that's no lack of appreciation of the incredible work that you've put in personally to resolve this issue. I think you have really done yeoman's work on this to try to make something very poorly written, very confusing, more understandable, and provide more certainty. I just feel that this does not accomplish the goals that I see are important under Senate Bill 100. I'm a former member of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. I am a strong proponent of the land use system. It's a good economic development tool as well as a good environmental tool. And I just don't think that I think that the development interests are benefiting greatly from this draft, but I just can't see that it is something that I can support. But as I said, it's through no lack of appreciation for the incredible work, and I think you've done the best job possible under the circumstances.
Thank you. Any other discussion on the Dash 2 amendments? Senator Shields.
I know that you had a conversation the other day with Senator Morris. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
This question is a conversation that I had the other day with Senator Morris. Well, last Tuesday when we had the initial hearing on the Dash 2 amendments, there was a mini explosion over the reference to aggregate mining in the Dash 2 amendments and how that was specifically exempted from Measure 37 claims. We've removed that specific exemption.
What does that mean, Mr. Chair?
Well, it means that if somebody wants to, if somebody has property and they're interested in aggregate mining, that they would either be entitled to compensation for regulations preventing them from aggregate mining, or those regulations would be waived, so that they would be allowed to go ahead with aggregate mining.
Okay, the way the draft now is.
The way the draft is now written. Correct, Senator Shields.
But the subtlety is that after all of the effort with regard to aggregate mining in the last session, there was a basic agreement that as long as the governor was involved or some of his staff or under his direction in some mediation and ongoing conversations, that there wouldn't be any legislation related to aggregate in this session. And that one line kind of violated that principle.
That's right.
And that's why it was so easy for me to say, yeah, let's stick with the principle that we set up during the interim.
Yeah, and our work group wasn't aware of that discussion.
And that's the strange thing about it. They weren't told about it at all, so
yeah.
They didn't know about it.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Shields. Any other discussion? Katie, could you call the roll on the Dash 2 amendments, please?
Senator Byers?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Chair Ringo?
Aye.
Dash 2 amendments are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 1037 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I'm going to vote for this bill today. We have last week spent many much time going over. There are a million things to hate in this draft and very few to like. And
very few, Senator Byer?
Very few. I can easily count the things to like on one hand, Mr. Chair. Having said that, if this bill was to come back to the Senate in the same version out of the House, I would be voting against it. I'm going to vote for it today. I'm going to vote for it on the Senate floor because this bill needs to go to the House, and so we can hopefully get rid of all those things that we don't like and maybe get some things in there we do like. So that is the reason I'm going to vote for the bill, and I just want to be very clear about that.
Thank you very much. Is there any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Byer, I certainly agree with you. We will certainly probably want to put different things in, however. I will also be voting no, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Katie, could you please call the roll?
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
No.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Aye. And the motion's adopted, and I will go ahead and carry that bill. Thank you, committee. minority report at work here. And let's go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 731. Representative Dingfelder.
Roger. Roger. This is what we see from here over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll just hold the microphone.
You do.
Good morning, and thank you for including Senate Bill 731 in your list of work sessions. For the record, my name is Representative Jackie Dingfelder, and I represent House District 45. I'm here today to present you the Dash 2s, which hopefully you have in front of you, and it is a complete gut and stuff from the original bill. Let's see if I can get this to stay in here. Okay. The Dash 2s are very different from the original bill. The Dash 2s provide an approach for water measurement that is a cooperative cost share and voluntary approach. And if you recall in my original testimony, one of the reasons that I was promoting water measurement is so that we have a better sense of what's available for conservation in the state. And as we're managing very how much we're using in order to adequately plan for our limited water supplies. The approach in front of you, I convened a work group at the advice of the chair. We had many members and a lot of input in this approach. And I will say that the majority of the stakeholders are supporting this approach. I can't say, unfortunately, that we have 100% support, but I do think this is a reasonable compromise, given that the original bill required for all water users to measure their water. This bill is a voluntary cooperative cost share approach. And I am working closely with Representative Jensen. If you do recall, in the 2001 legislative session, we passed a bill, House Bill 2713, that created a cost share fund through the Water Resources Department to pay for measurement devices. That fund currently has $1 in it, so part of this approach, by having this in statute, I think it gives us also more leverage as I'm looking for funds both at the state and federal level to help landowners offset the cost of water measurement devices. The way I look at this approach, Mr. Chair and committee members, is similar to the way we have a cost share program for fish screening devices in the state, where the state takes on about 75% and the landowner takes on 25%. It's been a very successful program, and we hope to be able to duplicate that program through the water measurement cost share fund. So that's basically it. The Dash 2s, as I said, are gut and stuff, and it talks about a phased approach, focusing on the high priority areas. Again, it's really to encourage landowners who aren't currently required to measure their water use to engage in this voluntary cost share program. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I also know the department is here if you have any questions, and they do support this approach as well.
Okay, thanks. Does this have a fiscal associated with it?
No, it does not.
The fund is already set up, like I said, but it has no
money in it, and we'll be looking for non-general fund monies for that fund.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Representative Dingfelder? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Adam, do you want to... I don't know if we have a sign-up list, but... could you give us your two cents? Is there a fiscal on this?
For the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resource Department. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with the Dash 2 amendments, there would not be a fiscal impact on the department. The bill as drafted, of course, would. And I guess I just wanted...
The original bill would
have a fiscal impact. And again, I think, as Representative Dingfelder said, this sends an important message to the state and its water users that water measurement is important, and it also holds the department's feet to the fire in terms of moving this ahead. And I think the important thing is that this Dash 2 amendment emphasizes collaboration and cost sharing as compared to a blanket regulatory approach, and we like that approach.
Okay, thank you. So the department supports the Dash 2 amendments?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Is there anything in this Dash 2 amendments that is different than what could be done today without it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, I don't believe so. I mean, I think the department could today, under its existing resources, do what's in the Dash 2 amendment. I think the important part of the Dash 2 amendment, at least in my opinion, is it sends out a strong message, a legislative policy message to the department and the water users, and requires the department to come back next session and report on the progress that we're making. And so it really, to me, sort of highlights the need for this kind of activity.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add, there's currently... Just to respond to Senator Beyer's question, there's no statutory requirement for the Water Resources Department to come in and give updates to the legislature on the progress of water measurement. So this codifies, or as Adam says, says to the Water Resources Department, this is a priority. You're going to come back to the legislature in 2 years and tell us how this program's going. And it also encourages the department, if we do get money in this fund, which I'm working very hard at right now to see if we can get some resources, for the department to work with landowners to let them know about the availability of these funds and to encourage them to, if they're not already measuring their water, to look at this opportunity for a cost-share program working with the landowners and also providing technical assistance. So there is, the short answer is yes, the requirement to report to the legislature is something that the Water Resources Department is not required to do currently.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Sombrin, did you want to testify? And Richard Kosterson, do you want to come up as well? Richard, have you had a chance to see the Dash 2 amendments?
I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead and sit down.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stonebrink, go ahead.
For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And I think you can see that this, the intent of the original bill, then Dash 1s, and now this amendment, basically go back that it's getting the Water Resource Department geared up for the ultimate, which would be 100% water metering around the state. Now, I realize this amendment now has the word voluntary in it, but if you look at some of the rest of the words, especially like page 2, line 2, it says that that they want to focus on water users that are not currently required to measure water use. Now, to me, this speaks volumes as to what the intent of the proponents of this legislation are gearing up for. On page 2, line 7, utilize a phased approach to implementation. And I'm sure you've all heard the story of how to boil a frog. That's what phased approach is all about. You just gradually do a little at a time until you have everyone. Now, the irrigators of this state use, and this is approximate, 5% of the total water. And a lot of that water is reused again, either back into the stream or charges aquifers and so on. Now, let's suppose that you put water metering on everything that was going on, and you gained a 10% efficiency increase. That would be a pretty big target, really. That is one half of 1%
increase.
Having 95% of all the water running into the ocean, you'd have a 95.5% of the water running into the ocean. And in the meantime, you've placed a burden that is extremely costly on the water users. And then I wonder what is the ultimate after you find out either how much people are using. Is it to try to find ways to shut them off? Or the ultimate, I think, is now we need to charge them. The state shouldn't be giving this water away. We know who's getting exactly how much water. We need more money for the state, so let's start charging for the water. I think it's a bill headed in the wrong direction for the economy and for agriculture in this state. I urge you to vote no on.
Mr. Cosa-San.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Richard Cosa-San, Water for Life. Following up, Representative Dean Felder, I do believe she made a very strong, concerted effort in the House to deal with a number of the stakeholders, and I think she should be thanked for that. At the end of the day, however, I think Water for Life probably would disagree with the direction of the legislation. In a perfect world, the legislation, I think, would fit quite well, but we're not quite there yet. In terms of following up Mr. Stonebrink's remark, I think you have a number of people, especially irrigators throughout the state, who are very nervous about this approach. To follow up what Adam Sussman indicated, he said something to the effect that this would perhaps hold the department's feet to the fire. And there's two handouts there, and I would refer you to existing statutory provisions found at 543.10 sub 2. The owner shall construct and maintain, when required by the commission, suitable measuring devices at such points along the ditch as may be necessary to assist the water master in determining the amount of water that is to be diverted into the ditch. So that is very clearly authorizing, affording the department clear authority to require measuring devices to be installed at the current time. The other handout, Mr. Chair, is a reference to 537.211. When issuing a permit for water use, as you will see in subsection 1, the department has the ability to condition the permit, and most permits today are conditioned with measuring requirements. Continuing in terms of what Senator Beyer indicated, if one were to look at current administrative rules found at 692.50.0060, diversion works and measuring device installation, this is clear authority vested with the department and water masters to require measurement at the current time. I guess at the end of the day, Water for Life would reluctantly oppose the legislation. We asked for a designation of a pilot program, a clear delineated sunset, and I think rather than statewide, if the legislative body looks at this direction, I would encourage a regional basis. I think that down the road would highlight whether the program works or not works. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cosa-San. Now, I have a question. There was a question to an earlier witness as to whether the bill did anything, and one of the suggestions was, well, maybe not very much. Are you tell me what you think. Does the bill do something significant or not?
Mr. Chair, yes and no. In terms of existing authorities of the department clearly has express authority today to require measurement. In terms of trying to go out and encourage a voluntary approach, I think that's the key.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, I think Water Resource Department made it obvious that when he said this bill would hold our feet to the fire. It's a clear signal, strong signal, and that's what Representative Dingfelder said also. It's a strong signal to get out there and do that. And Senator Beyer made a good point. Is this bill necessary? Can they do everything that they're doing now without it? Yes, they can.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Oh, Senator Shields.
Richard, you talked about the bill making a lot of people nervous. I think there's nervousness around water, with or without bills, generally all over the place. My question, I guess, is will this kind of reporting actually affect usage in any way?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, my first inclination is no. The system of water distribution has an inherent system of checks and balances now. If someone is overusing, inappropriately using, probably the first person that's going to pay attention to that is their next door neighbor. So I think there are adequate checks and balances now. Long term, negligible at best, I would argue.
Glenn, would you like to comment on that?
I would, Chair Ringo, Senator Shield, I would agree with that. And that's kind of where I come up with this. That we're going to, at the very best, there would be a very small amount of water that could ever be so-called kept in streams, if you will, because the water metering would show that somebody had overutilized. I want to tell you, just take a moment, some of our areas in the state, and I hesitate to say this because then it may send the wrong signal, but I might as well tell you. Their land is not flat as this table like it is in a lot of places, so they need to flood irrigate. Now, if it is all flattened, and to do that, you're going to have to tear up the native grasses and you know, work the ground and do it. So they need to have a larger wall of water go across those lands because it's not. There's little bumps and places. But what happens when you introduce a larger wall of water and it runs back into the river after it's gone through the, actually sometimes more pure than when it left. But that's the way the irrigation does. If you metered that, okay, you'd say, you're in violation. You don't have that much water coming. You're violating your rate and duty. So, but they don't look at, well, do we then meter what's going back into the stream to prove that we totally didn't utilize more than what the law allowed?
Follow up, just with regard to that, you might not have to meter. Couldn't you have some kind of formula where you have a sense of how much would go back in the stream?
Well, Chair Ringo, Senator Shields, in essence, I think that's what's happening on the ground now with the water masters, because they know what happens.
Yeah.
And they look at this, and Richard's exactly right. People that are on those, either the irrigation canals or on the stream further down or other places, they know there's a limited amount of water they're going to get. And if somebody's cheating, and I've been there and watched them, they'll be the first ones to scream, and they'll stop that rather quickly. I would hope that some of you would, when you consider this, and maybe in the future years, that you would have a chance to go to an area early in the session and look at some of these, what irrigation, what is really happening out there on the ground. I would really encourage that.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I know I'm supposed to be a city boy, but I have spent a fair amount of time, at least when I was younger, on the farms and ranches of relatives in Central Oregon, and watched the irrigation and watched the mint harvest, and in fact ran a mint still and all that good stuff. And I guess in the context of this whole thing, nobody's going to argue that at some point, sometime, we're going to have a water crisis on our hands. You know, when it'll be, I don't know. More and more people using more and more water all the time. I think that at some point in time, there's going to be some real jurisdictional conflicts over who gets the water and where it goes and so on and so forth. So I just have some real concerns and just measuring may actually be of benefit, because you may be these folks may be proved to be much better stewards of the water than some of their more urban counterparts. It's just a thought.
Chair Ringo, may I just
respond in about 10 seconds?
Right. this year we should look at the total abundance of water that we have, east side, west side. Offshore, off-stream storage is not even being considered. We only consider it when we have a drought. We should be thinking about it now. This state has more water than we could ever utilize if we just knew how to take care of it and manage it. And water metering isn't going to do anything, honestly.
Okay. This debate's ending right now. Thank you very much. Don Schoenberg, do you want to give your 2 cents on this bill? He's saying no. Anybody from Water Resources Congress? Okay. Nobody else wants to speak on this bill. That's fine. We are in work session. Is there a motion on the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would move the dash two amendment.
Senator Burdick has moved the dash two amendments. Is there any discussion? Katie, call the roll.
Senator Byer?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
Chair
Ringo? Aye. Motion adopted. Is there a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 731 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved Senate Bill 731 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Senator Atkins, good work, but I just can't. I live where it irrigates. Where we irrigate, and I don't like sending signals as policy. So it's good work, but it's just a little. I can't do something. Put my name. I mean, I always, this is a matter of principle. Always vote no when this body sends signals because no one really listens to the signals.
Right.
So,
okay. Any other discussion? Katie, call the roll, please.
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Motion adopted. Senator Shields, would you like to carry the bill?
Yeah, I already gave you one.
I did? Well, we'll move on.
It's okay.
Okay, thank you. And let's open a work session on our mass gathering bill. Let's see, that is
863.
No, number 569. Matt, could you please just describe what the current amendments do on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as you may recall from our last hearing, this was Senator Starr and Senator Brzezinski's mass gathering bill. The dash four amendments take out most of the new language in the printed bill. It takes out all of sections 4 through 6, which set up a new permitting process under the Department of Human Services. It also restores the original definition as the size of a mass gathering, which in statute is 3,000. The printed bill would have changed it to 4,500. This puts it back at 3,000. The new language in this is it gets rid of the somewhat ambiguous references to a 3-month period during which someone can be permitted to hold a mass gathering. Current statute says you can hold a mass gathering for up to 120 hours within a 3-month period. No one's entirely sure what that means. So we get rid of that language and replace it with language that says up to 2 events per month during the summer and up to 1 event per month during the rest of the year. Right now, a lot of folks were being told by the counties that they could only have 1 event every 3 months. So this is a significant increase over that.
All right. As far as you know, is this a pretty much a consensus amendment?
Mr. Chairman, that's my impression from talking with Senator Brzezinski's office.
All right. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to have 10 seconds worth of testimony on this? Okay, fine. And we're looking at the dash four amendments?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
All right. Could I have a motion on the dash four amendments, please?
Mr. Chair, move the dash four.
Senator Atkins has moved the dash four amendment to Senate Bill 569. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move the bills.
Okay. Our committee staff, we need to recommend that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, move that we rescind the referral to Committee on Ways and Means.
And pass it to the floor with a due pass.
Pass it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right.
The coaching.
Senator Atkinson has moved that we recommend we rescind the referral to Ways and Means and move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Let's see.
Do you have a sign-up sheet on these other bills?
Just don't think of you. Let's go there. Might we get that signed?
Yeah. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1032. Jerry, are you here on this bill? Who else? Randy, okay.
Oh, no, we passed the floor to ask for me to carry it.
Right, from their perspective.
Hi,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Gary Conkling, here today appearing on behalf of the Beaverton School District. I want to thank you personally for introducing Senate Bill 1032 and for calling this hearing today. In the last decade or so, the Beaverton School District has added more than 10,000 students, and just to put that into proportion, if those 10,000 students were a separate school district, it would be among the 15th largest districts in the state. It would be larger, for example, than the David Douglas District or Greater Albany or the West Lynn Wilsonville District. In that same period of time, the Beaverton School District patrons have approved 5 bond measures, a number of them exceeding $100 million to build new schools and expand existing ones. Just an interesting FYI, the debt load in the Beaverton District now totals $8,500 per student. The causes for this growth include land use policies that have encouraged infill development to achieve greater densities. Our district is also where light rail is, and we happen to be in the area where much industrial development has occurred. The net result of all of this is that we've used up all of the land bank school sites that we've had, and we had a fair number of them. Today, we can't find available sites inside the UGB. The last site that we have obtained came through the condemnation of a well-known nursery in the northern part of our district. What Senate Bill 1032 was intended to address is the next round of expansion for us and what we anticipate will be expansion for other districts, so I'm not here to speak on their behalf today. We anticipate that we will have to look outside the UGB for one or more additional school sites. And what we're trying to find a way to do is to do that within the context of the land use planning system. We're not, as most of you know, land use planners, nor does the land use planning system, at least in our view, perfectly anticipate school sites. While I think regionally the need for school site land is included in the land analysis, sometimes the land that's added to the UGB doesn't coincide with where individual school districts need land for their sites. We recognize that this is a problem. This is not a bill about blame. It's a bill about trying to find a method to collaborate so that we can move forward in identifying potential school sites outside the UGB that will ultimately be in the path of urban development, so that those schools, even if they are built before other development occurs, will ultimately be the center of residential and planned communities as the area expands. We also, when we acquire these sites, face substantial amount of expense. System development charges are for sewer and water lines and other traffic improvements make development of a school an expensive proposition. So it also makes sense for us to be in areas where, to the extent possible, some of those costs can be mitigated or at least shared. What Senate Bill 1032 has done is reminded people of some of the issues and some of the solutions they didn't like. A number of people have informed me that I haven't reformed very much from previous attempts, and that's fair. But what happened this time that's different in the past is that we've had a productive conversation with the Department of Land Conservation Development, with Metro, cities, with home builders and others. And what I'd like to tell you is that I think we have come up with language that we can agree to that provides fundamentally two things. One, some guidance from metro cities and urban service providers as to where we should look outside the UGB. And two, language that will encourage Metro to provide an accelerated process to add those lands once they have been established, the need has been established, and they we verified that you can provide urban services so that those lands can be on an accelerated basis added to the UGB. Randy Tucker from Metro is here. He can tell you a little bit more from the regional agency's perspective. What we have tried to do is, in our amendment, working with Metro, and Metro, as Randy will explain, has actually worked on the specific language, have suggested that perhaps this provision initially be aimed specifically at the Portland metropolitan area, where I think the nature of this problem is most acute. The department has, I think, talked about a possibility of looking and seeing how we might broaden this later in the use of urban reserves and other communities around the state. But for now, at least, the bill that we're talking about would be aimed at Portland and would involve basically school districts in that area with metro cities, counties, and other urban service providers in that area.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager from Metro. As you know as well as anyone, Mr. Chair, Gary and I have been through some battles on this very issue going back to 1999, and it's nice to be in the process of beating our swords into plowshares here. We're having some good conversations. Certainly when the bill was introduced, the form that you're looking at it there got our attention and the attention of several other people, but it's led to some very productive conversations with Gary, and I think on our end to a better understanding of the problems that are faced by Beaverton specifically. Just as a little bit of a review, the last bill on this issue was passed in 2001, which subsequent to that, Metro did bring in some land for a school in the Bethany area the north part of, I don't know, outside of Beaverton, I guess. In our normal scheduled UGB expansion process and periodic review, we also have a process for bringing land into the urban growth boundary for purposes other than residential purposes, and specifically mentioned in our code is schools. That's called the major amendment process, and that exists right now, but there have been some changes to Goal 14 that sort of streamlining of Goal 14, which is leading us to streamline our own code on how we expand the urban growth boundary. Right now, Dick Benner, one of our attorneys, is in the process of, in his words, cutting it down from 46 pages to 22 pages, I believe, some severe pruning. And so we're going to be doing that anyway. In the context of that discussion, Dick has suggested that we can modify the major amendments process, and the language that he's drafted up as language that you should be seeing in a work session subsequent to this hearing would direct Metro to establish a process for expanding the UGB for schools, for public schools, when the schools can't be reasonably accommodated in the UGB, and that when they must be accommodated before the next scheduled time that we would normally do an urban growth boundary expansion. And so the process that he's laying out that I think we're in agreement on would be that we would establish a process that would get a final decision in 4 months, and that schools would be considered a specific land need under the statutes that would allow us to do that. The piece that's not in the language that we've got drafted already yet is the piece that Gary talked about in terms of the collaboration between Metro and the district in terms of determining the likely direction of urban growth. We want to work on that. That's something that we can do, of course. We can collaborate without statute, but we're fine with trying to see if we can put something in statute to make sure that that happens. And just the last thing I'd like to say is that this bill is one of several that implicates our urban growth boundary setting process, which is certainly complicated enough for us. As you know, you may know, we are also undertaking a process analogous to the one that's been proposed at the state level in Senate Bill 82, which is to take a big look at how we plan for our region's growth. And so we are going forward with that. And as part of that discussion, there are all kinds of interwoven threads having to do with urban reserves and how do we project into the future, what our needs are going to be. Is there a better way to expand the boundary than we do it right now? And so we're undertaking that right now, and certainly schools need to be a part of that discussion as well. At any rate, I'm pleased to say that we're getting pretty close to some language we can present to you, and we'll be back soon with that.
Okay. We'll be back soon with
language, bill language.
Okay, good.
So they don't have language?
They do not have language right now. Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay.
Yeah, I have some questions. So this is related. So it's your intent to just make this apply to Portland. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, yes.
Okay. And a high-growth school district is defined in the bill as enrollment of 5,000 students?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Atkinson, this definition is in existing statute, it is an interesting question about, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, whether or not this should be restricted to just high-growth school districts or not. When I wrote the original provisions of Senate Bill 1032, I included that to narrow it, not necessarily imagining that that would forestall people not liking the bill, but at least narrowing the reason why they didn't like it. So I don't know whether that provision is necessary or not necessary. All kinds of districts, whether they're high growth or not, could have this problem.
Mr. Chair, could I tag on to that answer also? I had some communication with my team yesterday about this question, about whether it should be restricted to high growth or not. And a preliminary response was that maybe it doesn't need to be restricted to high growth districts. And one reason is that when we expand the urban growth boundary, sometimes we create a high growth area. You look at Damascus, we've just added a whole bunch of land there. Over time, that's going to develop, and you're going to have a high growth school district there, even though it's maybe not one now. The bill, as we anticipate it coming to you, will be restricted to the metro, but maybe not to high growth school districts.
Okay. Just a couple more questions. So high growth school district means public school, doesn't mean private school.
Right.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, in current statute, that's my understanding.
All right. And so, Randy, what you're really doing here is you're moving this up on the priority list, right, to be adopted into the UGB. Is that right? What this bill does policy-wise?
I'm not sure I'd use that terminology because that has a heavily articulated meaning in the context of land use laws. The term priority, with respect to the farmland and all that, all that stuff.
So what I'm getting at.
I'm sorry?
That's what I'm getting at. But
well, I mean, we're already in a situation in the metro area where a lot of the land that surrounds the urban growth boundary that is not farmland is gone. It's been brought into the boundary. So, some of the areas that we brought into the boundary, the council brought into the boundary in 2002, I don't say we because I wasn't even working there then, are farmland. Some of the areas that were brought into the boundary in 2004 for industrial use are farmland. We're running out of the exception land anyway. And the region continues to grow. But I don't think this necessarily feeds right into the farmland priority statute. It's more, if we need the land for the schools, then we're going to go through a process to try to provided. And the thing that's different about schools than about other kinds of land needs is that they need to be in particular places to serve particular populations. And so, you know, even now you don't have to avoid farmland if by avoiding farmland you can't satisfy the need that you're trying to address.
Hmm. Well, just a thank you. Last thing, you know, I live in an area of the state that needs to grow. It's caught up in complete litigation over land that's exception land that's not really suitable for agriculture. However, the rules up here say it is, but it's not. We have schools that have a hard time growing. We have communities that have a hard time growing. But all this bill does is says that we can make it easier on you in Portland. But in Southern Oregon, if you're a little private school, I think there was a thing in the paper yesterday, 3 years of litigation to finally get a building, even though the land was given to them. I've got little communities that's trying to grow and can't seem to wait through all the UGB exception process. So people throw their hands up and move. So I, just as a policy maker, have a hard time making it easier for one part of the state when the rest of the state's just going to suffer because they don't sit in the high growth school district definition of 5,000 students.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson.
Sorry.
You know, I represent one particular area of the state, so.
All right. Thank you.
I have a question for you, though. In the amendments, you had said that they might be focused on Portland only, and then you questioned, well, gee, was it really necessary to do that? Could they be drafted statewide so that Senator Atkinson is not going to say, well, you're just taking care of Portland?
Mr. Chairman, our conversation with the department indicated that there is a recognition that this problem, perhaps in a slightly different fashion, extends to other places in the state. And the department can speak for itself, but I think there is an interest in seeing whether we could model a process to help find a constructive way for school planning to occur that today doesn't seem to be, at least based on our experiences in Beaverton, working all that well. It might involve urban reserves or some other land use planning technique. So I think that there is an interest in seeing this issue addressed on a more statewide level. The department certainly expressed that interest to us. The challenge that we have is that Beaverton is about ready to go out for yet another bond measure. And as you all know, we only have one tool to pay for schools. And it's school bond measure. And we've gotten pretty good at passing. We'll be looking at another high school site, another middle school site, more elementary school sites, probably at least two. We have been expanding existing schools. We now have the distinction of having an elementary school that has a capacity for 1,000 kids. We have, when you look at the top high schools in terms of attendance in the state, you'll notice they're almost all in Beaverton. These schools are today sitting at over capacity.
Which school has capacity for 1,000 kids?
It's the Beaver Acres. We're also the district that at one point had so many children that showed up at one elementary school, we had to create basically a mobile home park for our kindergarten. We created a whole other site for that. So it's more than a slight problem. And when we get the money for a bond measure, it's fairly specific. As you know, a bond measure, you have to do exactly what you say you're going to do. And we need to move along a timeline. We're already behind. As I mentioned, we probably have enough students sitting today in hallways, including my two children who attend Southridge High School, that we could fill up another high school that would be one of the largest high schools in the state. And that doesn't count the new development that's occurring every day. We add at least 800 to 1,000 students every year and have for a decade. So there may be other school districts that have problems, and I you know, I share them and I hope for them. I don't know of anybody who has our problem. I guess on one hand it's a wonderful problem to have, but it is a challenging problem, especially given the land situation that we have, that we just don't have any place to put them, the schools.
Thank you. Questions? We'll look forward to your amendments. Oh, Senator Shields.
Gary, bluntly, what you're saying is there's probably, at this point in time, not a way to take care of Senator Atkinson's kind of problem without jeopardizing your own solution in Beaverton right now.
But Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I don't know that that's true or not true. I don't profess to be a land use expert, and I, if someone had a solution that would address his problem, you know, I don't know how to solve it, I guess is what I'm saying. I'm having enough trouble solving my own problem, as you can tell, but trying to solve somebody else's doesn't seem like it would be all that useful or desired by anybody.
Go ahead. You have a suggestion.
Oh, my right. Suggestion is that we hear from Mary Kyle McCurdy and then maybe Bob Rindy. Thank you very much. And look forward to the amendments. Bob, do you want to come up too?
Good morning, Chair Rindo and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to address Senate Bill 1032. That this bill has been introduced at all demonstrates the serious issues that school districts are facing in siting new schools to accommodate a growing population. School siting, school population forecasting, land use planning, transportation planning, school financing need to be better coordinated. However, the original version of Senate Bill 1032 is not the answer and, in fact, goes in the direction of even less coordination among jurisdictions than exists today. It essentially would have given individual school boards land use supersiting authority for schools. And in my written testimony, I go into some details about why I believe the current bill is not the right solution. But we have reviewed the concept language that Mr. Conkling and Metro are working on to substitute for this bill, and we do support that. There was a day-long conference on school siting issues sponsored by the University of Oregon's Community Planning Workshop last November that highlighted the need for increased coordination of planning of land use, transportation, and financing for schools. And those are reflected in the concept that we've seen. And it is particularly crafted to the metro area's UGB planning process and planning cycle, but I do have an answer for Senator Atkinson in just a moment. But we also believe that there are additional tools that should be considered. Probably not in this bill, maybe not in this legislature, but they are things that have come up before, such as system development charges on new development to fund the need for increased school capacity, allowing schools to locate as an outright use, not a conditional use, in most urban zones, and requiring school sites to be set aside in large residential developments, including large UGB expansions. And we're eager to work on legislation to substitute for this language. To answer the issue brought up by Senator Atkinson, we've always believed, and we've worked in the metro area on this point, that in the hierarchy statute that you mentioned, 197-298, sub 3A, there's a provision that allows an urban to bring land into the urban growth boundary without consideration of the priorities for a specific identified land need. And after the 1999 session, when Senator Ringo and Representative Haas, I think, brought us all together to work on the Beaverton and Hillsborough school district issues, we supported using that part of existing law to cite lands that were, in fact, brought into the Metro UGB in their last UGB expansion. As Mr. Tucker mentioned, the Bethany site that was brought inside the UGB for a school site was on farmland, and we believe that a school site is a specific type of identified land need that can be located on farmland without regard to the priority cycle. So we believe there is an option in current existing law for the school districts that may not be impacted by this bill as it ultimately comes out. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bob, I guess let's just hold off comments until we get the amendments, because otherwise we're just commenting on the problem as opposed to the solution. Is that okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mayor Kahn made the point I was going to make about specific land needs for the rest of the state, so I think.
Okay, good. Well, thanks very much, and I look forward to seeing the amendments when we have them. Let's close that public hearing and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863. Don, do you want to come up? Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Don.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're in a short session on Senate Bill 863. Don, could you just get us oriented on this bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to speak today and for holding a work session on this. This is a long-standing issue that we've had before. We've attempted to bring to the legislature for three sessions now. Pleased that you would bring this forward for us. Simply what the bill does is provide that when a landowner purchases another piece of property, in this case in an EFU zone, and it has an old dwelling on it, or more than one in some cases, that you can remove that dwelling, get a permit to replace that dwelling at any time in the future, and that is transferable to a family member.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee, could I have a motion on this bill? There's no amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 863 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 863 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And then let's...
who's carrying?
Jason. Senator Atkinson will carry that. And let's open a work session on Senate Bill 347, and I'd just like the committee staff to describe any amendments on this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what we're looking at currently are the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 347. These are much the same as the dash one amendments with one significant change, which is in the second paragraph of Section 1, requires laboratories to report quote-unquote validated results. This is something of a term of art in the industry and was important to both sides. I talked with legislative counsel for a while about this and determined that the amendments as drafted don't take away any existing requirements on the part of water suppliers to report to the department, so we didn't think it was necessary to add language specifying that since that's already in there.
Okay. Well, I think we have a constitutional issue on this bill, so let's go ahead and just roll this over to the hearing on Thursday. So let's close that work session, and I think that completes our business for the day. And the hearing is adjourned.